staying in the academic realm alone for us has not been tenable. And that's why social medicine has been a way for us to express praxis, right? The beautiful marrying of education and action. Either you're a part of the system by either not seeing the system or choosing to not address it, or you're fighting it.
Welcome to Social Medicine on Air, a podcast where we explore the vibrant world of social medicine. We learn through conversations with healthcare practitioners, researchers, and activists who are working to create a more just and healthy world. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Social Medicine on Air. Today, we will be interviewing Dr. Hugo Flores Navarro. And Hugo is a physician originally from Monterrey, Mexico, and he has worked developing Compañeros en Salud, which is a Partners in Health sister organization in Mexico, and is currently doing a Master's of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. Welcome, Hugo.
Thank you very much for having me here. Thank you, Jonas and Brendan.
Yeah, thank you for being here with us, and we are really excited to have you, giving your perspective and your global perspective, actually, in social medicine.
Maybe for the first question, Hugo, we can talk about, you have a quote that was in an interview, and you said, "Our work is not complete until global health is not just a charitable hobby, but the realization of a fundamental human right." Can you talk about what you mean by that?
What I find very concerning, and this is the reality, not in every country, but at least in Mexico, where I'm from, but it's also the reality here in the US, is that access to existing life-saving healthcare is seen as a commodity. What does this mean? This means that some people may have access to that based on their availability of insurance or their purchasing power. But, you know, it's something that you buy that is, you know, like if it was a skateboard or, you know, a vacation. And, you know, you see in these places different levels of quality of healthcare that are available for different groups of people. And you don't see this in places that have national health systems, such as the Scandinavian countries, for example, where, you know, everyone gets access to the same healthcare, and that the health system is something, you know, equalizing in the population. So what you see more on this side of the world is that people that have means have better access to care, sometimes access to an excess in care, and people, as they get poorer, they have lower access to care. And then you see these gaps in every indicator, in life expectancy, in maternal mortality, in child mortality, that are very, very different between poor and rich people, you know, by big numbers. Like, there, you know, there are maps, these maps produced on DC and Chicago, where you see the maternal mortality in poor neighborhoods being like 10 times the maternal mortality in the richest neighborhood. So this is what I think, it's unethical in principle. And I think this idea is something that needs to be eradicated. Like, healthcare should not be treated as a commodity. It should not be, you know, governed by the laws of supply and demand and by purchasing power. It's unethical that there is a cure for a disease in one side, and there is people who have this disease in, you know, the other side, and they kind of have access. And every time someone dies because of a treatable illness or condition, this is a human rights violation, to my opinion. And it should be considered as such. But it's so normalized. It's so normalized in the way that many terrible things have been normalized in history. In the way that slavery was normalized a few hundred years ago. I really think this is a big problem of our, you know, generation, of our civilization. I don't know how to express it, but it's a big thing.
This make me think a lot when you say like it's get normalized, especially when people look at healthcare as a luxury, and then especially in countries where people make a lot of profit out of healthcare or out of access to healthcare. So I think but I'm thinking about the narrative that when people present you failure as a personal poverty as a personal failure, so your access to care would it depend on yourself? So that's what I was thinking while you're going through that. And in other countries, like let's say in some countries in Europe, where they have universal care coverage, now it is trending. You don't see those those health indicators so low when compared to the US, when you compare to Mexico, for example.
And maybe you can talk about how you have tried to embody this idea of health as a human right, and what does that look like on the ground as you're building organizations, working with people, and kind of boots on the ground implementation.
I think what it means is that when you are doing work, one is focus on the most vulnerable population that is within your reach. I mean, it doesn't mean you have to go to the poorest country, but you know, wherever you are, most likely are going to be, poor people or other forms or marginalized populations. I think we should need to focus on those people for starters. And the message we need to send is to give these people the highest possible level of care that we can and that exists, and not conform to less than that. I think the battle is lost when we succumb to this logic. You know, this is a lot exported by, you know, public health schools that we need to do adjustments, right? And that selective primary care or these interventions that is like, okay, maybe this, because what that says is like saying, maybe this is not adequate healthcare, but it is adequate healthcare for the poor. It's about the other. You know, it's a lot of emphasis about the otherness. So what I dislike a lot about people in decision-making positions in health systems is that they are designing systems and programs that they would not use for their own families, you know? They are designing health systems for others. This is a big moral and cognitive dissonance. I think as citizens, we should not allow that. Like, for example, every person in the government, every person in, you know, the Ministry of Health should be subject to the healthcare that they are designing and providing. In the case of Mexico, this is not how it goes. You know, you will see the high officers having like private health insurance while they are, you know, approving and designing an inferior health system for the open population. No, this is not ethical. So what we have to do when we put this into practice is not fall into that and say like, no, whatever we are doing, and this is one of the mottos of Partners in Health, is treating every patient like our family. And this doesn't mean maybe like we're going to love every patient like we love our mothers, because that may be not possible. But we can create healthcare systems in which we would feel comfortable sending our mothers to, you know, that we can do and that we should do. So for example, when we're working in Chiapas, even our project is relatively small, but I think our standard is like, is this care good enough so that we would feel comfortable to bring our mothers here to this clinic? They just show up. That should be our standard. And we don't have to accept anything else. I think when we start, you know, people get very technocratic, you know, about like cost effectiveness and things like that. I mean, that is not bad if really they would apply those standards for themselves, you know, because it could be the case that that has many other ramifications. But even if we have a health system that has its limitations, then those limitations need to be equally distributed, you know? Like, what is immoral is to subject the poor to those limitations only. That is the true discrimination. That is a true, it's violent. You know, that's a true violent act. And it's perpetrated by the state. It is taught by schools, even medical schools. I mean, Jonas was trained in Mexico. He also would know that the way you're training medical schools in Mexico is, you know, the patients of the public system are, you know, to experiment, are to do your trial, and then your patients in the private sector are to be treated as clients, you know, completely differently. This is not correct. So the way to apply it in practice is to actually treat the poor patients with dignity and give them the care they need and advocate for the care they need and not conform to anything less than that.
You know, when you have healthcare, you have access, quality and cost. So literally, Hugo just go over, let's say, the quality of healthcare that we have in Mexico and also the access that he previously mentioned. Yeah, I was trained in Mexico. My medical school was a public school, and the hospital I was trained was also public hospital. But I never had a chance, let's say, to have people, high-ranking people from the government coming to those hospitals. Those people usually, they got their care from private, high-quality. It's like a, I don't know if that word exists, but like a cognitive dissonance or even a incongruence into like the people who lead you, what they offer to you, actually don't consume it. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I think that the way that you're describing giving healthcare to the poorest with an eye to the poorest and also alongside imagining yourself in that same health system, it reminds me of this idea of accompaniment and like how that is a central value for Partners in Health and the way that we would like to deliver care to others and for others to act towards us too. So is that something that you have tried in Partners in Health Mexico to embody?
I would say in Partners in Health, that's our base belief. Everything that we do is based on that. Like sometimes it has there are practical limitations, you know, but I think the difference is that we don't say this is good enough until it is good enough, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, you know, I think that's the difference. It's like maybe not, you know, in many cases we are really providing top care in many ways. In some, we are not, but we don't say this is good enough and this is what is appropriate for this population or for the poor. If we are not there yet, then we will try to get there, and we don't lower our bar. You know, it's a continuous struggle. And it's not that Partners in Health is going to solve the problems of the world in terms of like this healthcare injustice, but we need to be the ones sending the message constantly and saying, this is not right, this is not right. Because, you know, the logic is like, you know, has been, it's okay, this is right. I mean, it's okay that the poor just get like vaccinations and like oral rehydration, you know, the Gobi thing, the growth monitoring, oral rehydration, breastfeeding, immunization thing. You know, we have to say it's not all right. And that's why it's also very important now with the Sustainable Development Goal, but also with the new declaration of Astana that is supposed to be the 40th year anniversary of the Alma-Ata Declaration, which was, you know, health for all for year 2000 that didn't come into materialization, mostly because of the introduction of selective primary care. But now I think we have to be very careful in the terminology that is being used, because now there is a lot of this universal health coverage, but that is not really universal, and it's a term that I think it has been co-opted, and it's advocating for additional, let's say, interventions in care that are still selective. And this is very important. If you want to go to the WHO page, to the website, at least it says it very clearly. And it says, the you know, something like universal health coverage doesn't mean that everyone has access to every intervention for free, or to every treatment for free, which I think is very sad. I think the standard for humanity should be everything that is available, like, let's say scientifically, everyone should have access to. And if for some reason it's not possible because, you know, there is not enough for that, then we should figure out a way to distribute it that is fair. So, yeah, I don't know if that answered your question, but yeah, I think we have a role in just keep pushing the agenda.
Okay, so Hugo, that also makes me think, though, you know, if healthcare and the most just approach to healthcare should be coming through democratically determined policies and health coverage and so on, how does that work while you're working in a nonprofit organization that's parallel to the government, while the government is also providing a certain amount of healthcare? Do you have interactions with the government? Is that cooperative or confrontational? How does that work in your context?
Well, there are many elements to your question. One is, I don't think it should be democratic, because democratic means people could vote on that. And I think the decision doesn't necessarily be... I mean, I think the decision could be done by the governments, you know, by technical bodies, but it should be done in a way that is fair. Mm-hmm. I would say fair instead of democratic. You could also have a democratic process that is not fair. So I think the process should be fair, and it should be, there should be a discussion on distribution and what's the best way to distribute health resources. Above that, there should be a philosophical discourse or discussion on if the scarcity is true or created, which I think that's a bigger problem, because I think the scarcity is created. So we have to have those elements. One is, are the resources really scarce, or we have been just made to think they are scarce? And then the second, whatever is available, how we are going to distribute. And I think that should be fair. Right now, it's not fair. And then about the relationship between nonprofits and the government, you know, PAH is notorious for only working with the government. And it's of course, this can only be done in a cooperative way. And I think our message with the government is, because we help the government with populations that are either difficult to reach or are very poor. You know, we help the government in populations where the government usually cannot, you know, provide its regular services. That's the case pretty much in every site. So I think what we help is saying, telling the government, you know, it is possible to do it. I mean, it requires some investment, but it is possible. And I know the governments enjoy that, because, you know, there are many people within governments that want this to work. And, you know, sometimes the functioning of a health system is complex, you know, and it depends on policies that are definitely way beyond the reach of 99.9% of the workers in a health system, you know. So, you know, we would like to think that we accompany the government in trying to fulfill these missions. But yes, I think that this, let's say, battle is more at the macro level. It's an ideological battle between, I would say, market-based ideologies and human-centered ideologies. Yes. And I think that's where the that's what is a, you know, that's the struggle. And I think there has been an effort, you know, over the years by neoliberal policies, a lot of it, you know, enforced by the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, to dismantle government, to dismantle public services, to privatize. It is true that many public, you know, services have been stagnant, have not been efficient. It's not that it's perfect, but I think I'm not sure that the dismantling of the public sector has been innocent, just because pointing out of the inefficiencies of public administration, or it is not innocent and it's just to make more profits for companies. If I had to put my money on one of the two, I would put my money on the second, that it is not innocent. So, no, I don't think it's ethical to make profits in certain sectors. I don't think it's ethical to make profit in healthcare.
I was having this discussion with several doctors recently, talking about global health and all the more foreign expert or more foreign scholar we receive doing those wonderful research, publishing them. Not only people from the global south are not part of it, but so many times they don't benefit from it. And someone was asking me if I know an organization that make a little bit difference on how people approach global health. And I say Partners in Health or Compañeros en Salud in our case. But he asked me what make Compañeros en Salud or Partners in Health a difference compared to others. If you have been in my position, how will you reply to that person, Hugo?
Partners in Health works only with the governments, right? So I think that's one important distinction. The other thing, Partners in Health is associated with an academic institution, so trying to make evidence-based interventions, which is also not the bread and butter of a lot of NGOs. I think it's becoming more popular. But I think the ideological part of Partners in Health is very, very strong. I think Partners in Health really believe that it is very unethical to have what, you know, even there is nomenclature within PH, like a stupid death. A stupid death is a death that is due to a preventable or treatable cause. So we think that is unethical, for example. We think everyone should have access to all the scientific advances that we have come up as a human race. I think we believe in the value of every life. We cannot make this decision of you know, that is being made by bureaucracies, like these people live, these people die. Mm-hmm. Everything you do as elective care policy, you are deciding who is going to be left out, who is not going to receive care.
Right. And I even think that the language choice is so important. For example, stupid deaths, it carries a certain amount of weight with it that says that this is not right. You know, it's not just a statistic. It's not just a simple choice with an unexpected outcome. It's to say this is, in a sense, morally unacceptable. And it's also a call to action just within the language choice. I'm curious, too, and generally about the role of community health workers in your work. I think that community health workers have a very central role in Partners in Health. And I think that that model is being taken up by other organizations. But how do you use community health workers in your organization? What role do they have? And also, how do we elevate their voices in their work?
It has been increasing. I definitely think that community health workers have a lot to offer and are essential to achieve, you know, health justice, especially in rural places, but also perhaps in urban places as well. So I think they're valuable in many ways. One is, you know, they know their communities. I think one is just from the very elementary thing is job creation. I think community health workers are actually a way to provide a lot of people jobs and to have a better connection between the health system and the community. And they can do a lot of things and they can do them well. I mean, right now, community health workers around the world do all sorts of things. Like, it started with, you know, observed therapy for tuberculosis and HIV, but right now they are doing mental health care, chronic disease care, epidemiological surveillance, like a lot of like public health work. So I think that's ideal. There is one pitfall, is that it should not serve, you know, as a substitute for the other levels of care that are necessary. Because, you know, I think it community health workers can also be co-opted by this speech on, you know, incomplete care for the poor. And it's like, oh, you know, if it's just for the poor, they should not have doctors, they should not have nurses, they should have community health workers. And that is incorrect, but they cannot be used to substitute the system. I think we just have to be very careful of that, because mm-hmm. I think there are initiatives that are like, okay, let's forget about doctors and nurses and let's just do community health workers doing like some vertical interventions and preventive interventions. And that's not, I think they should be the last link in the chain, or not the last, but they have to be part of a full health system, not isolated.
So what is the role of a community health worker then? What does a visit from a community health worker look like? And, you know, we don't really have them too much, at least in the American system, in the mainstream American system. So how could we use those roles in the United States?
There are some cases here in the U.S. For example, I know a couple of people that work as community health workers here in the U.S. For example, linking patients that have severe social issues, you know, homelessness, substance addiction, mm-hmm. poverty, you know, people that need extra care. So one of my favorite examples of community health workers is, they are also highly trained, but one of the most successful interventions of PMH was the Sputnik program in Russia, in Siberia, that was to follow up patients with multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, patients in very difficult conditions, like homelessness, drug addictions, stuff like that. So there were these community health workers actually tracking the patients, you know, around the streets, like where they are, and making sure like they were taking their medicines, they were coming to their appointments, and they had like almost zero mortality rate.
Wow.
So this is the thing, this is the magic of the, you know, in a way, a lot of the other health professionals are like stuck inside the health facilities, but community health workers are actually in the community. We are now training community health workers to provide psychotherapy in Chiapas.
Wow.
And we think it's going to be very successful. But also, I mean, the way, for example, a community health worker can talk to a person in the community with, you know, with training in psychotherapy is going to be completely different than if you have a, you know, an urban, upper middle class doctor giving psychotherapy to a person, you know, from a rural place. So the communication gap, is reduced, the information asymmetry is reduced. It's about linking, you know. I mean, these distances sometimes are difficult to overcome, but pretty much every program with community health workers is better, provided that the rest of the program exists and works. You know, you cannot have a community health program for HIV if you don't have drugs for HIV, and diagnostics for HIV and follow-up for HIV, you know, and complication management for HIV. You cannot have a community health worker program for chronic diseases if you don't have drugs, you know, reliable supply chain and diagnostic tests, and you know what I mean?
And I wonder also, you know, one of the things that's been on my mind in this discussion as somebody who's from the developed world, the global north, whatever language we want to use, is how can we make partnerships between the global north and the global south? And I think your career has kind of spanned both of those, and you've done a lot of work integrating those two. So maybe you could speak to kind of the challenges or the ways that work between the global north and the global south can go off the rails and end up harming the communities? And also, what are some ways to do that in a more healthy, productive way?
You know, I think there has been a lot of qualitative analysis on this topic. You know, the typical criticism of medical missions, of like, poverty, tourism, things like that. Those things exist, but I think they are now being on the radar more. There are advances in that regard. And I think for us, we have hosted a lot, dozens and dozens of volunteers over the years. And I think it has been a very good experience, both for the organization and for the volunteers. So it can be done. You just need like a local organization, you know, probably an organization or an individual that is aware of this, let's say on the north side, to speak, and the local organization that is structured enough and, you know, savvy enough to accommodate this. Mm-hmm. So I think that's more of a technical issue. I don't think it's inherently immoral, you know? It's more of a know-how, and I think it's getting better over time. What is the problem? I would say there are two big problems that are macro and are structural. One is the funding culture. You know, people who really influence and drive the agenda for nonprofits are funders, and what they are funding and how they are funding it. So over this past years, there has been this big trend in like sustainability, in grants that are like 2-3 years or 5 years, and after that, you know, whatever program needs to be self-sustainable. That in healthcare doesn't make any sense. So I think that has driven the implementation of a lot of unsuccessful projects. But organizations don't have a lot of power to change that. I think over time it's been changing, and a lot of big foundations are getting more, if not professionalized, but, you know, a lot more aware or savvy in these topics. It has been improving slightly, but I think that's one of the biggest challenges. And the other one is really monitoring the money quantitatively. And I think this is the part that is lagging the most. So we need to track for every grant, where does that money go? And at the macro level, we need to track down what percentage of that money actually stays within the recipient countries, and what percentage of money stays in the north. And this is just very simple. For example, let's say, you know, I get a grant, like a $3,000 grant, you know, to go to Mexico to help in something. And it sounds like, you know, the mental health program in Mexico is getting $3,000. And I'm using $3,000, but, you know, in reality, this is millions. But I buy my plane ticket, and I get there, and I take some of my salary myself. And in the end, like, most of the money really stayed within this country. And you know, maybe when I went to Mexico, I spent some in hotels, and I spent some in food. And maybe some stayed in Mexico, but how much of that money stayed in the recipient community? Probably very little or nothing. And that is, to me, the most dangerous aspect of the aid industry, is that, again, I don't know if this is innocent or we just have created a machinery that is enormous, operated by the North, that has a lot of people working in it, that is just feeding job creation for people from the global North. And, you know, many of the programs imply supplies bought from the global North, consultants coming from the global North, contracts to firms coming from the global North. And so what is, you know, when you say I give a grant to this country, what does that mean?
Yeah, that reminds me too of what happened in Haiti after the earthquake in 2010. And Jonas, maybe you can speak to this as well. But I remember reading that only a few percent of the monies that were donated ended up with Haitian firms, Haitian individuals for doing the work itself. And a lot of it went to, you know, donor country businesses, for example, purchasing rice from Texas and sending it to Haiti. And while that alleviated the immediate food need, it also put many Haitian rice farmers out of business because they couldn't compete with free. So there's a lot of ways that aid can harm as well, and we need to think very critically about how we do that, like you're saying.
Yeah, and we can even add the case of American Red Cross, where we say like they receive like half a billion. I don't have the numbers, but I can Google it. They only built, let's say, 6 houses with all the money they receive, and after that they didn't do nothing for the people. So there's a lot of things like connected among one another, and when you approach the global south, you cannot approach it with a mindset of global north. And the people you want to help, you have to literally look at what works on a local level, and then try to invest on that. Then trying to bring them or to scale something that you think may be good or useful to them.
Well, Hugo, maybe you can speak as well to the way that you first got into the work of social medicine. You know, was that training or personal experiences, and why this is something that's so important to you?
It was a little bit by accident. Like, I don't think I knew the term social medicine when I got into social medicine. But I knew about inequities. I learned about injustice. What really has bothered me since I was little has been the class system, I would say. And the class system, you know, not defined as people having different levels of income, but about the transmission, the transgenerational transmission of opportunities among different classes, and the lack of social mobility. You know, the class system really works as a social architecture, like, you know, like the Brave New World of Aldous Huxley. Some people are, you know, this is also a philosophical, you know, issue about what is considered the uses of the poor. You know, what are the poor useful for? Well, the poor do the jobs that no one else wants to do. The poor buy the things that no one else wants to buy. You know, the poor are useful for the society, and the poor are useful for the elites, at least to some extent, or in some proportion. Yeah, this is, to me, something very bothersome, and it's very difficult to dismantle. And then this translates into health. And in healthcare is, I don't know if more relevant, but very relevant because it translates into life and death and disability and disease. So the poorer you are, the most likely you are to die or to suffer a disability or a complication from a disease, and vice versa. So I think I, you know, decided to study medicine when I was very young. And, you know, I think it was just an application of how can I apply this perspective of inequity into medicine. And I think that's social medicine, because social medicine rejects that as a principle. Yes.
Would you mind talking about your time with the Zapatistas as well, and what that changed in you, or what problems or opportunities or imagination change that you had during that time?
It was a summer, so one of the experiences that could be considered volunteerism, but I think to me what was very amazing to see is that how in a setting of very limited resources, community organizing can do so much. For example, one of the most amazing things about Zapatista communities is the, well, how politically savvy they are, one. And for example, the progress in gender issues compared to their, let's say, peer indigenous communities in Chiapas, where, you know, some, in some communities, like, girls are still being sold as wives. But in general to Mexico, and in general to, like, the rest of the world is amazing. You know, you have full participation of women in the government. You have a justice system that works within the communities. They have, for example, alcohol prohibition because of its links to domestic violence. It's really amazing. Like, you feel like, you know, if these people had access to more resources, these communities will be thriving so much. So that was very interesting to me. It's the same case like with Cuba. I mean, Cuba maybe, you know, Cuba has the confounder of the authoritarian regime, but if you see the Cuban health system, it's just better than, it's better, and it is very, you know, resource limited than many systems in the world. So I think it tells you that it is not just about material resources, that the community element, the organizing element, is very, very important. But I think what Zapatistas have, you know, it's a very strong sense of equality, you know, among them. And I think they really reject the idea that, you know, some people are more important than others.
That's fascinating. Maybe could you speak to the dangers of a volunteerism approach in general that you've seen?
I mean, I have both perspectives, you know, someone who has done it and someone who has received it. I mean, for you to go in a thing like that, it's very enriching, and you can learn a lot. I learned a lot. Danger, I think it relates to, I don't want to say this to put blame on local communities, but I think the danger you can make in a voluntarism experience is related to the capacity of the local place to manage you as a voluntourist. So I think what we can do, and because, you know, the power differential of the voluntourist tends to be high, we need to be, I think what we should do at both at the individual but at the institutional level in the Global North is to be very careful about these partnerships and not let the voluntourists roam wildly. Zapatistas are a very, very structured organization. You cannot just show up there and do whatever you want, right? So I think it's about that. And, you know, one of the best cases of successful foreign aid is Rwanda, but also Rwanda, the government is very strong. You cannot just go as a nonprofit in Rwanda and do whatever you want. Sadly, as you can do in Haiti, for example. So you see how the same force can be constructive or destructive, depending on how it is channeled.
And if there's that level of integration with local communities, local governments, local community groups, that goes a long way towards making the gains sustainable and the resources offered go further.
Yes, not so constructive. I don't want to make an absolute case against voluntarism, because I think it's a way in which a lot of people gain knowledge and awareness. I think it just has to be done properly. And we have to name it as it is. I think we have to make... Because I have seen also in some of the institutions that do this properly, I would say Notre Dame, for example, there is this ideology that you're not going to there and solve the problems of the people. You're not going to there and, you know, be the savior. You're going there to learn. Mm-hmm. And I think as we... As people have this in mind, and as people are trying to be humble and just be there and not have their own agenda and just try to be helpful in whatever the organization decides that they need help with, I think it is more positive. And as you don't do that, it is more negative.
I think Hugo is a really, like, I think Hugo is really well known and respected when it's come to environmental health. I don't know if he wants to make any comment, let's say anything about climate change or anything on that sense related to health. That will be like the last thing I will ask him, because I know this is something that is extremely important to him. Someone who's really close to nature, love meditating and all those kind of things. And I don't know if you want to make a comment about that.
Yes, this is actually different, because, I mean, now we have this another element that is pushing us towards very rapid change, right? Like, we can, you know, think about philosophy for everyone, but the environment is saying, like, a little bit like, you are doomed, and we are doomed by a failure in, I think, defining the purpose of life as humans, and we have done it in a way that is destructive. It's a big problem. It's a big philosophical problem, and it's a big practical problem. And, you know, I think this is where everything collapses, you know. Everything that we're talking about, like, this is an existential threat to humankind. I think we need to develop... It's obvious that more awareness and climate change is not causing change. We have known this for many decades. There is all the information there. We are not making changes. This is a problem. We need to find a new radical, let's say, philosophy, I would say, a new redefinition of the purpose of existence for humans. Right now it's acquisition, it's development in the shape of acquisition of things, of experiences, but it's not about improving relationships. It's not relational. It's not like, well, let's define development in how we relate to others and how we relate to the environment and how happy we are, you know. It's not even things like that. So I think we need to develop new philosophies. And they need to have two elements. One is that they need to not be anthropocentric. So I think a lot, and I don't know if this is Judeo-Christian thought, but this idea about placing the human at the center of the universe and thinking that everything else is at the service of humans is a very negative and destructive principle to live by. So I think any philosophy that will take us out of this hole is not going to be anthropocentric. And the other element is that any philosophy that we define needs to have in itself a call to action that is inherent. For example, what I like about liberation theology is that the principle is that you cannot say you believe in liberation theology unless you dedicate yourself to the poor. You know, it's not about if you think that the poor are important, it's that you have to deliver your life to the poor. So, you know, the philosophy itself in its name involves the call to action, and you cannot say that you share it if you don't act upon it, you know. That is very interesting. And so I think that element and the non-anthropocentric element are very important. To me, the problem is that the world has so many problems. You know, we are dealing with a lot of violence, you know, armed conflict, ethnic conflicts, racism, gender violence. We are dealing with so many problems that the agenda is very saturated. And I think, and you know, you cannot say these things are not important because they are important. But I think as we struggle, I think we have to find a way to combine all these struggles into one. I think climate change is, as much as it has attention, it's not there in the agenda of action. You know, the carbon emissions are still rising year by year. The, you know, sources for fossil fuels are still developed. The economy is still based on that. Our consumption habits are still based on that. And so I think we need to... I am not sure that we are going to be able to solve it before things become very critical. But I think if we are in that position when we have to face very critical conditions, at least we have to be ready with a new way of conceptualizing life and our position in the planet and in the universe to adapt to it successfully, I would say.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Hugo. I don't know if Mendon has something else to say, but I think that was really intuitive and instructive, and thank you for giving us like a much bigger and more broader aspect about, like, let's say, quality and access to care in Mexico, global health, environmental health, and also a little bit about liberation theology. I don't know if Brendan has something else to comment.
No, thank you so much, Hugo, for your time, and it's been a wonderful and informative discussion. Thank you.
Thanks to you, it was my pleasure.
This is Social Medicine On Air, co-hosted by Brendan Johnson and Jonas Atlas. Produced by Brendan Johnson and myself, Raghav Goyal. Intro music credits to Savage on YouTube and outro and incidental music to Smith the Mister. And a huge thanks to Clara Brand for our logo and visual work. You can find her on Instagram at _off_brand_. If you would like to share your story on the podcast or have any questions at all, please reach out to us at socialmedicineonair@gmail.com or at Twitter at @socmedonair. And if you haven't already, please do subscribe, join our social media, and leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It would mean so much to us. Thank you so much for listening.